Welcome to the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. Your guide, of course, to better cricket, whether that's playing it or coaching it, doesn't matter to us. We're here to help you out for a half an hour or so. My name's David Hinchliffe. I look after things here. And helping me to help you are two very fine cricket coaches. The first of which is the Director of Cricket Coaching at Millfield School. It's Mark Garraway. Hello, Garris. How are you?
I'm all right, actually. I've got my end of half-term cold, which always happens on the last day of half-term, which I'm pleased about. Tells me that I'm just about to go on holiday for a week, which is good. So, looking forward to a few days off and then a bit of coaching at the back end of next week up in Cheshire. Doing some stuff, and I know you love my name drops, but I'm doing a session with Michael Vaughan and Glenn Chappell next week. We're working together, so looking forward to that.
He's worked with them all, hasn't he? He's worked with them all. Secondly, it's the cricket professional at Portsmouth Grammar School. It's Sam Lavery. Hello there, Lavers. Still on a bit of a rugby tip at the moment?
Yeah, still got a little bit of rugby going on in the 14s, which is good, but cricket's bare, going to be back in full swing next week, so one-to-ones kicking off the winter, setting some targets with the boys, and then into weekly sessions with the lads, so I've probably got about another 4 or 5 days of no actual cricket coaching stuff, which will be cherished, and then it'll be back into full-on stuff.
Is there anything, I mean, you know, sport, the rules of different sports aside, is there much of a crossover in the way that you coach things?
Oh, enormously, yeah. There's still a massive comparison in kind of general coaching methods. So just the standards that you're trying to set in terms of professionalism and commitment to what they're doing. The commitments, the different elements, and like the basic trying to achieve a high standard of basic skills or basic decisions or basics across the board is still kind of the primary focus, and then building other things on top of that is where you're looking to go. So I generally think you can coach to a fairly high standard in almost any sport as long as you can get your head around the fundamentals of it. Now that's the fundamentals of more than just the kind of physical stuff, but you need to have a basic awareness of how they need to develop their skills, how they need to develop their tactics, their decisions, their physical development, etc. But if you understand all of those things to a pretty basic level, you can take players to a fairly high level. In fact, in almost any sport, I would have said. Obviously, then when you go beyond that, there needs to be a little bit more expertise and. I wouldn't say that's necessarily something I carry within the rugby area, but it's something that you can take them so far. And fortunately for me, I'm working with an under 14 group, so it's probably fits in quite nicely with how we're looking to develop the guys and get some really strong basics in them before they prepare for rugby into the to top end of the senior school. So it works out quite nicely.
Yeah, Pete. People are people, aren't they? You know, you have different characters and different personalities, but people still remain people, no matter how, you know, much we like to think that, you know, different people are attracted to different sports and everything. I mean, it's not actually that different, is it? When it comes down to it, you've still got all different types of characters in all different sports, haven't you? And so, if you know how to work with people, then the detail of the actual sport becomes less important.
Yeah, absolutely. For every one person who wants to know everything about it, wants to know every statistic, and for every one of you, David, there's someone who's the opposite end of the spectrum who has no interest in what's going on. So, as long as you can get your hand around different personalities and try and find a way to engage with them, then you'll probably find you can make a bit of improvement, regardless of the kind of sport that you're in.
Well, that's a handy little segue, Lavers, to the topic that I wanted to discuss today. Talking about statistics was an article that I read this week about a statistic that we don't use, but it was suggested that it might be interesting for us to take a look at that in more detail. And that was chances. I guess that's chances is the number of wickets a bowler takes added to the number of times that there's a drop off their bowling. And that would in total make chances. And that might be a better indicator of how well a bowler's done, because, of course, a bowler has no control over whether the... unless it's a caught and bowled, of course, but the bowler has no control over whether the ball is caught or not by the fielder. So what do you think about this this idea of measuring chances? Is it fraught with danger because there's too much subjectivity, or is there something to work with?
Well, there is a lot of subjectivity because there's so much, there's so many variables, I suppose, in the drop chance. So if you take, and I'm going to take it out of cricket, I suppose, now, if you take Michael Jordan's quote about the fact that he missed more shots than anybody else in NBA history, you know, then the people that are want to take the risk or want to create the opportunity in the field, I'm talking about, not necessarily with the ball, in the field, are obviously going to create more chances. And we've talked about that repeatedly, you know, making sure you give it a go, and unless you're in a certain situation at, right at the end of the game, then you go for everything, is one of my sort of coaching mantras, really. So I would expect the fielders that subscribe to that mantra to create more chances than those that don't. And we all know that there are fielders that don't go for chances more than some as well. So there's one variable. The second variable is that obviously a bowler can create a chance off an absolute filthy pie as well, can't they? You know, it's not just down to good bowling that creates chances, and we see that even at the top level of a game, and probably see it more prevalent within the lower levels of a game and the club cricket and schools cricket, that a low full toss, which in some level of cricket would go out the park, often creates the opportunity. And I remember in my very poor club bowling career, I remember being asked to bowl long hops at this certain batter because we had a little bit of a longer boundary over there, and basically he hit the pull shot in the air the whole time, and we would stick two men out at deep mid wicket and he'd hole out every time we played against him. But you know, I suppose some people would say that's good bowling because I bowled to a plan, but actually it was probably more in line with my stock delivery, I think, that got that wicket. So I do think there's some variables, and but I do think it's interesting to look at these things, because unless you have good discussions about it, and Sam might come in and completely disagree with me now, and that would be wonderful if he did. But I think it's a tough one from a subjective point of view, because there's so many variables within both the fielder and also the bowler, and the fact that you can bowl a pie and get a wicket or create an opportunity off of it. And the last thing is, I love the picture because it's Strauss dropping Sachin Tendulkar at leg slip, which is just hilarious. So that gives me massive amount of ammo, which I'm really keen on having as much as possible.
When it comes to runs and wickets, there's no subjectivity, is there? You know, it's in the book. It doesn't matter whether, as Gareth said, it was a filthy pie or an absolute Jaffa that got the wicket. The point is, you got a wicket. But it's not. There's a lot less. There's a lot more open to interpretation when it comes to whether the ball was dropped or not in the first place. So, Leavis, do you think, even with that limitation, do you think you could standardise in some way and still use that statistic? Or do you think it'll never be a statistic? It might be used in one-off situations, you know, within teams or whatever, but it can never really be used as a general statistic.
There are plenty of bowlers and batters out there who would also say that the statistics generated through wickets aren't really credible either, because of umpiring decisions and various other things. So there's still, even though it's black and white, doesn't mean it's still right. So we're looking for what's going to be the lesser of two evils, really. Now, initially, if you look at the idea behind the creating chances theory, then it does sound like it would be a better way to measure it initially, doesn't it? Because you think, well, actually, he's done his job. Like they said, if someone doesn't catch it, it's not his fault, etc., etc. Now, quantifying that and quantifying a half chance or a genuine chance or whatever it might be then becomes a little bit more complicated. So my opinion would be, if you're going to do it, you've got to really commit to it, and you've then got to have quite a detailed, almost grading system of the chances that are being created. So if there's any doubt, then something's having a different score to something that is a genuine opportunity that's been created. So again, it's something that needs a lot of thought, and if someone can come up with a system, and I've kind of tried to do it loosely in the past and then suddenly realised that
if it's going to be done, it's got to be done really properly. It actually takes quite a bit of time on your day and takes quite a lot of planning. So if you can quantify everything that that is put together in terms of chances and the level and the quality of chances created, then there's no reason why it shouldn't be something that is introduced into our game. But again, coming up with that system in the first place is the tough bit, and it might be that we're actually doing something that is a little bit more trouble than it's worth, and we've got a system that isn't perfect but works to a reasonable degree in terms of tracking via runs and wickets, and maybe we should stick to that. But I'm sure some will be going out and having a real crack at it, and I hope they do, and I hope they come up with a system that works and that betters just gauging runs and wickets, which is what we do at the moment.
What do you reckon about 25%, a quarter of chances are grassed? What's your thoughts on that as a coaching pair, you two?
I'm surprised at that.
In international cricket?
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, that's... Bearing in mind that we dropped, you know, we caught 60% in our club last year. Our international fielders, that small amount better than... club fielders.
It's really interesting.
Instinctively, I would say maybe not, but you know, it depends what you count as a drop, don't you?
Yeah,
as well,
absolutely.
It?
So that was the first thing that came to mind. But also, I remember it wasn't a day; it was longer than a day. I remember a test match against Sri Lanka at Lord's where we batted first, got millions, bowled them out for five. Then they went back in again, nicked off a couple, and then the wicket got slow and we dropped nine catches, right? We dropped nine catches in this test match in the second innings, and eventually they batted for what seemed like about 3 weeks, and the test match was drawn. So if you think about it, in that innings alone, where I think we ended up getting eight wickets, we created 17 chances for a wicket and only got eight wickets. So there will be innings like that where you just have a stinker, and then equally there will be innings where you might not drop any or drop one or two. But and instinctively I felt that was quite a high number, but when I started to think about individual games and some of the worst ones that we had in terms of catching, I could see that might be the case. But yeah, it's an interesting one. It shocked me initially, but I'm less shocked now maybe.
I feel like it could be handy if you had it, as long as the definition of a drop and all the rest of it was clear and probably defined by the same person every time. Then it does sort of lend a team feeling to that statistic rather than an individual feeling to that. Rather than saying, oh, this bowler, got 20 wickets, you could say this bowler had 35 chances, and then. You can say, if we work better as a team here, he would have taken 35 wickets, but he actually, he only took 23 or whatever it was. So that I think that might be interesting to look at it from a perspective of, come on, fielders, we need to help the bowler by creating more chances for him.
Yeah, I like the way they've transferred it into, they've gone on to talk about wicketkeepers, haven't they? And if the wicketkeeper's value and how that is opposed to his batting average, and if he takes another chance per game and what the value of a chance is and all that kind of stuff. But it'd be interesting to see if you can put that, obviously translate it down into your format of cricket and then translate the number of improved, if we can reduce it from 15 chances required to win a game, to take our 10 wickets, can we reduce that down to 13? And if we can reduce it to 13, how does that correspond to the number of runs that the opposition are scoring, the number of runs being required to chase and that kind of thing, which will be really useful information, and it makes it a little bit more black and white to an individual who stood in front of you talking about hypothetical catches. And if they know that actually, look, let's work a bit harder, if we can take it down by a couple, that's worth 40 runs. Then that's obviously got some value and some sway when it comes to engaging someone into really working harder on that aspect of their game. But hopefully fielding something people really commit to anyway.
Okay, let's wrap up this section with a quick piece of news. Just to mention that we are running our Coach of the Month competition at the moment, and that is for people who want to nominate their own coach. Head over to pitchvision.com to find out more about how to nominate your coach for Coach of the Month this month. Time now for the questions section, and here we answer a couple of questions that have been sent in by listeners to the show. And whether we answer those questions well or not, we decide on a winner of the best question of the week, which is a prize of an online coaching course from Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. And you can send your questions into us by emailing coach@pitchvision.com, and we'll tell you how to get in touch with us in other ways at the end of the show. And VPN has got in touch with us with a simple question, but definitely some discussion points here. VPN says, how can I improve my hand-eye coordination?
Yeah, good question. And it's something that scientifically, it would be fast. I don't know the scientific stuff behind it, to be honest, and it's probably prompted a gap in my knowledge that I need to go away and look at. But from an anecdotal perspective, and also from a practical perspective, from a batting point of view, one of the best drills I've seen to develop this would be using really small tennis balls. So you can get these small tennis balls, mostly seen in the subcontinent, and a thin bat, and bat with those is a really good way of increasing your hand-eye coordination. Then using those drills on a rough surface as well, so you see the ball reacting differently off of those surfaces. But a lot of coaching academies over there and lots of specialist batting sessions are done using thin bats and small hard tennis balls to bat against, because it obviously makes us watch the ball slightly differently, a bit more intently maybe, or a bit more precisely, but also that it works in terms of our hands as well. So that's a great drill of doing that. And then from a catching point of view, again the same really, is catching different sizes of balls, having different pace of ball coming into you when you're catching, maybe catching one-handed. So a good high catching drill for increasing your hand-eye coordination is catching soft cricket balls or incredibles that hit up in the air and catching one-handed. It works well as a body position drill as well, because it gets us underneath the ball a bit better, but also that helps our coordination as well. So basically any drill that you can do which increases the difficulty by reducing the size of something, or taking away one hand, or taking away one eye, or whatever the case may be, is a good way of increasing your hand-eye coordination. And that's something that you see keepers doing a lot of. We see fielders doing a bit, but when you go to the subcontinent, you see a heck of a lot of batters batting with thin bats. So if they bust a bat on the toe or on the edge, they get them cut down and they'll bat with thin bats. Ian Bell is somebody that had a lot of that type of practice within his pre-match stuff. So yeah, definitely worth looking at that from a batting point of view in the fielding one. Just catching lots of different balls one-handed, different feeds is a good idea too.
I guess the other question is, Lavers, is to take it to one step higher. Say, why are you thinking specifically about hand-eye coordination? Is there a problem underlying that, or is it something that you know generally someone said, oh, well, you know, to be good at cricket you have to have good hand-eye coordination, off you go. That'd be interesting to find out why that question was asked.
Yeah, he could well have had a really specific requirement for it, and it could be something very particular about his game that he wants to have a positive impact on by improving his hand-eye coordination. Or as you say, it could just be a really general open question about how can it be adapted. I would say that you can almost separate your coordination into two different methods quite easily, or two different spheres really, which would be your striking coordination and then your positioning or catching, which could come under that a lot of the time, coordination as well. So try and think about what it is. If you're looking to develop your batting and striking coordination, then it's something that, as Gareth has said there, you can just up the intensity and difficulty level just by reducing the size of the ball, reducing the width of the bat. I've found that actually again changing weight of bat again challenges coordination and makes you adapt again. Introducing different changes of direction of the ball, so Gareth's already talked about the floor, but obviously he can do that in the air as well. So striking coordination is one thing, and then positioning and locating your hands in a certain place would be slightly different. But again, it can be done in so many different ways. One of the really good things I've found is not changing the size of the ball enormously, but one thing, which is another thing that works really well, but having a ball that looks exactly the same, but you can get slightly different densities of it. So you can get a ball, just a nice yellow foam ball, which you can get two or three different densities of. So just hit it off a tennis racket, and they're obviously going to travel at slightly different speeds, even though you're hitting it with exactly the same impact. And again, that's just going to challenge visual and that movement as well, because they're unable to pick up the change in the change in density of the ball and the speed it's going to travel at. So anything that's challenging, really, if you find something difficult, it's probably going to take you outside your comfort zone, and it's going to challenge your skills and your eyesight and your coordination, that kind of thing, and it's eventually going to make you better. I guess the key thing is gauging your practice at the right level and finding something that's perhaps at your limit or just beyond your limit, rather than something that's very easy or something that's almost completely unachievable. So my priority would be just gauging the level of practice so that it's challenging you in the right way.
Next question is from Rakesh. And Rakesh is a bowler, and he says, my bowling speed is approximately 120 kilometres an hour, and I want to increase my pace to 130 or 140 in a month. Is it possible? And what drills and exercises do I need?
Possibilities? Well, I'd say it's unlikely unless you're going to do some monster amount of work. That's a huge performance gain. We talk about 1-2%. That's way up there. In such a short period of time, I think it's unlikely. So the first thing I would say is, if you were working with me and you came in with that type of statement, I'd say, right, okay, give me an example of somebody who's done that. That you're aware of, and the answer will be not very many, and I'm sure there are people out there that have done it, but there aren't very many that have done it. And then go, right, do we need to extend the time scale? So is a month a realistic time? Whenever we're setting any goal like this, we've got to make sure that the time is realistic. So we probably extend that, and then we break it down and say, right, there are two ways of really increasing pace, and they're often combined. And the first one is strength, and I think that's the easy win for me, is getting people strong, doing doing drills, making sure that they can land properly, making sure they can absorb force from the ground and use that force effectively, making sure that they can shift force as well. So, you know, you're looking at your medicine ball work in particular, or your heavy ball bowling in particular, which is a really good way of developing that. But, you know, it's most people that want to bowl, who bowl at 120 and want to bowl at 140, that probably their general conditioning isn't good enough, which is one of the reasons why they'd be bowling at 120 to start off with. And that takes longer than a month to get that general condition in place before you can start getting really specific with things like medicine balls and heavy ball bowling. So, extend your time scale would be the first thing. And then secondly, let's have a look at the technique. What are the reasons that are impacting upon your ability to bowl faster at this present moment in time? And I just look amongst the kids that we're working with here at school, and they've all got slightly different things. So we've got one lad who wants to bowl really fast, who's probably got the attitude to bowl really fast. He's certainly got the work rate to bowl really fast. But one of the things that he does when he bowls is he jumps far too high up in the air, and so what goes up must come down, and his body isn't capable of using the force that he gets through the impact of the floor and then back up his kinetic chain. His knees buckle, his legs collapse, and therefore he can't use that. So I think back to somebody like Chris Tremlett, who played for England. He was somebody exactly the same, would jump too high, would land heavy, as a result of landing heavy would not be able to support his own body weight, he'd lose his structure in the bottom half of his body, and as a result he bowled at medium sort of 80s, 81, 82 mile an hour, where actually him bowling at 90 mile an hour would have been absolutely ferocious, because he was a pretty good bowler at 83. So that's one example. There could be front leg classification, there can be the ability to, where your arm is delayed, is obviously, your bowling arm is a little bit delayed, it helps us out because it increases the range of motion in that last phase of a bowling action, which increases velocity. There are loads of things, but ultimately most people from a physical perspective, their bodies wouldn't be capable of dealing with that loading. So I would extend the time phase. I would look to get your general conditioning in place to start off with before working more specifically on trying to absorb the ground forces with your legs and then being able to produce force by throwing medicines and balls around and also by bowling with heavier balls, which we're seeing some really good work coming out of Stephen Jones and various others, and ourselves here at school through Dan Hellersfay's programme is making a huge impact, but it comes off the back of general conditioning first.
Davis, it's great to have a goal, isn't it? But I guess it's also great to be realistic about what you can achieve.
Yeah, absolutely. We can all have ambitions and dreams, but I think there's a big difference between a dream and a goal, isn't there? And a goal, and you can go through the old method of goal setting and SMART or smarter goals and all those kind of things. But one of the key things in there is that element of realistic, it being realistic and it having a time frame that's suitable. In this instance, physically, there's not going to be a significant adaptation within 4 or 5 weeks that's going to see someone progress that much. And obviously, any technical change is going to take a reasonable amount of time. I would also say that if it's something that you're approaching today that you weren't approaching a week ago, I would imagine you've got time on your side and you're probably in a position where if it takes a year or it takes 18 months, that's probably going to be fine. Ultimately, if you get there at some stage, you will be bowling at a good pace, and hopefully to go with that, you'll have an element of skill and an element of control as well. But a lot of the time you'll find that with these progressions that we make, and especially the technical side, well, the technical side and the physical side, but they will often help with those other things, so you become a bit more balanced, you come slightly better aligned, and suddenly your skill and your movement of the ball and also your control and balance at the crease will improve. So it will benefit more than one part of your game, I'm sure, if you improve from a technical point of view as well as from a physically conditioned point of view. But yeah, it's got to be realistic, and it's got to be something that you don't give up on just because it doesn't happen overnight. You've got to commit a period of time to it, and probably a little bit more than a month is going to be required, and we're probably thinking about 10, 12 months, pushing on towards 18 months to see a real noticeable progression. Obviously depending on what support and what different elements of your bowling you're working on, but definitely the physical side be a big part, and those key factors that we talk about quite a lot on this show when it comes to generating speed are going to be there as well.
And that is the end of the show. We are going to do a couple of things before we finish. First of which is decide on the question of the week. Of course, that wins a prize of an online coaching course from Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. And the two people who are up for the prize this week are VPN's question about hand-eye coordination and Rakesh's question about increasing his speed in a month. Which one did you prefer this week, Gareth?
I'm going to go with Vipin's one about hand-eye coordination. I think it's something that I've seen work well, not necessarily just for hand-eye coordination, but just for general batting, really, is to use some small balls and some thin bats and adapting your equipment when it splits on an edge or whatever to help you out, and then also the catching stuff as well. So have a go at that, Vipin, and keep us posted.
Congratulations, Vipin. You can get your online coaching course from us. And Gareth, if someone was listening to the show and they wanted to have their chance to win the prize and also have their question answered, of course, how could they get in touch with us?
They could give us a call on 0203 239 7543 or drop us an email on coach@pitchvision.com.
That's right, you can also get us through social media. Our Facebook is facebook.com/pitchvisionacademy and our Twitter is @pitchvisionacad, and you can also keep up with the social side of things over at pitchvision.com. And speaking of that, if you want to get the podcast downloaded, the show notes, or just stream it online in your browser, you can do all of those things over at pitchvision.com/academy. Click on the podcast link and you get all the details for all the shows, going right back to the beginning. That's all for this week. We hope you listen next week. But until then, have a good week. Cheers, Gareth. Cheers, Lavers.
Cheers, fellas.
Cheers, guys. Thanks.